Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Tuesday, the 21st of April. Today, chaos at a United Nations conference on racism after an anti-Israeli outburst by the Iranian president triggers a mass walkout by Western diplomats. Also today, Barack Obama attempts to remove the stain of torture from the CIA.
The problem for the CIA is a lot of other people, you know, would like to see people held to account for what happened during the Bush years.
And how South Korea's Green New Deal puts Britain's fiscal stimulus to shame.
South Korea has invested more in green projects in its stimulus plan than any other country.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's got the news headlines and the papers.
The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, set to unveil an emergency £1 billion package for Britain's housing market tomorrow. It's expected to include a fund to build council houses, an extension on the stamp duty holiday, and a resumption of building projects postponed during the recession. A key part of the package will be a programme to build homes and support property owners. An ICM poll for The Guardian's offered clear evidence that rising unemployment, falling house prices, and the likelihood that 2009 will see the sharpest fall in output in a single year since 1945 are having an impact on the government's reputation for economic competence. 45% of respondents said they trusted the Conservatives to manage Britain through a recession, compared to 35% who said they preferred the Labour Party. President Barack Obama's visited the headquarters of the CIA to defend last week's decision to release four Bush administration memos detailing the agency's interrogation methods against al-Qaeda suspects. In a speech to about 1,000 staff aimed at restoring CIA morale, the president told operatives that he'd stand by them. Yesterday, it emerged that one key detainee, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, had been subjected to waterboarding 183 times, and another detainee, Abu Zubaydah, 83 times. After the release of the memos, human rights organisations called for a prosecution of Bush officials, as well as CIA interrogators. Tens of thousands of civilians trapped by fighting in Sri Lanka have fled to safety after the military smashed through one of the Tamil Tigers' last major defensive lines. Video footage released by the Sri Lankan Defence Ministry showed civilians pouring through a breach in an earth barrier, which the rebels had been using to hold back the military offensive. Pictures show the civilians wading through a lagoon towards the army's lines, some carrying possessions in bags on their heads. The Sri Lankan government's repeatedly claimed that the rebels are using the civilians as human shields, a claim supported by the UN and many other independent observers. The UK is ranked near the bottom on a table of children's well-being in 29 European states. Only Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania and Malta fared worse than the UK, which trailed at 24. The Netherlands topped the list and Scandinavian countries dominated the table in most categories. The UK fared poorly due to high numbers of youngsters in workless families, poor local environments and the low numbers in educational training. The table was compiled by York University researchers for the Child Poverty Action Group. Gordon Ramsay's flagship restaurants failed to make an influential list of the top 50 restaurants in the world for the first time. Restaurant Gordon Ramsay in Chelsea, London, which was last year ranked 13th, doesn't even feature in the San Pellegrino World's Best Restaurants Top 100 long list. It was the chef's first independently owned restaurant when he opened it in 1998, long before the growth of his worldwide empire of eateries, and it's earned him three Michelin stars. There was better news in the poll for Heston Blumenthal, whose Fat Duck restaurant retained its position at number two on the list. The top title went to El Bulli in Catalonia, Spain, for the fourth year in a row. Now look at the headlines. The speed limit is set to be cut to 50 miles per hour on many A roads in an attempt to reduce road deaths, out on the front page of The Times this morning. It could be the beginning of good news for markets as the FT reports that mergers and acquisitions have sprung back to life after 10 deals worth more than $27 billion were announced yesterday. The Daily Mail carries reports that working class children are betrayed by Labour, with details of a report which has found that poorer students are failing to get into university because of underperforming state schools and not because of class bias. A leading geneticist has told the Daily Telegraph the hope that genetic research could provide cures for a host of common illnesses has proved to be a false dawn. The Independent says that piracy off the coast of Somalia is being organised by syndicates from Dubai and other Gulf states. The story of how the 17-year-old army cadet Matt Deer died after taking steroids is told on the front of the Daily Mirror. And fatties cause global warming, according to the headline on The Sun, as scientists warn the rising number of obese people are adding to carbon emissions with an increased demand on food production. Those are the headlines today. More news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
In Geneva, at a United Nations conference on racism, dozens of diplomats walked out of a speech by the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad yesterday. He accused Israel of being a totally racist government. Britain's UN ambassador in Geneva was one of those to join the walkout, and the conference is already being boycotted by several Western countries, including the United States. Julian Borges, our diplomatic editor, he's in Geneva.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made a speech about racism and pretty soon got into issues on Israel that the European countries and some others were primed for and were watching for. In particular, he started talking about how the victors of World War II had used that and what he called the pretext of Jewish suffering during that war for the creation of what he called a cruel and racist state. And that was clearly crossed a red line as far as Britain, France and other EU members were concerned. And they walked out, a mixture of applause and boos from the hall.
And this conference is already being boycotted by the United States, Israel and several of the other European countries.
Yes, that's right. And there'll be a certain amount of, I told you so, but the states weren't there. But the states that have decided, did decide to take part, like Britain and France, are actually going to go back after Ahmadinejad stopped speaking and make clear that this was specific to what the Iranian president had to say, and it wasn't a boycott of the whole conference, which is supposed to be about racism, about the fight against racism. They're trying to make a point. Our problem is with Ahmadinejad, not with this conference.
How damaging is this piece of diplomatic theatre to the conference?
Very damaging, because they're trying to make some serious points about the blight of racism in the world, and this was supposed to be a follow-up meeting to see if any progress had been made in addressing issues of racism and discrimination. This will completely overshadow that, and it's very difficult for now for the conference organisers to get their message out, because all the oxygen of publicity has been sucked out by Ahmadinejad and his opponents here.
Because the last conference back in 2001 in Durban was also a bit of a fiasco.
See, yes and no. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation about it. A lot of the very sort of outrageous talk was in a separate conference document by NGOs participating in the conference. The official conference document didn't have all that much in it that was offensive. And the British argued they didn't have really much at all in it that was offensive and unacceptable. And so the conference itself in 2001 and this conference is not all that controversial per se. It's all the noise that surrounds it that is the problem.
Julian Borger. And there's full coverage of the conference today at guardian.co.uk/world. Also on The Guardian's website, Jonathan Jones, The Guardian's art critic, on his love of comics and graphic novels. guardian.co.uk/art to read that. Patrick Barkham's portrait of an Alzheimer's case is at guardian.co.uk/health. And Ian Sinclair on the late J.G. Ballard at guardian.co.uk/books. Barack Obama visited the headquarters of the CIA yesterday as he aimed to draw a line under the George Bush era. The US president has banned the interrogation technique of waterboarding and overturned Bush's policy of stating that it did not amount to torture. Ewan McCaskill is in The Guardian's Washington office.
Well, I think there'll be a lot of alarm within the CIA over the prospect of prosecutions, you know, arising from the release of those memos. Obama gave a promise in an accompanying statement that there would be no prosecutions, and I think he's reluctant politically to stir up something that he regards in the past. The problem for the CIA is a lot of other people, you know, would like to see people held to account for what happened during the Bush years. There'll be, you know, lots of civil rights groups, there'll be congressional committees, quite a few Democratic members of Congress would like to see some action. And there's a prospect of actions being brought overseas, like we saw the recent attempt in Spain, although that looks like it's going to fall by the wayside. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's other attempts too.
The former head of the CIA, Michael Hayden, has been criticising Obama and defending the practice of waterboarding. Are his views widely shared among the CIA?
Well, I think the... He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal at the end of last week, just as the memos come out, and then he was on television again on Sunday. His view is that, waterboarding and other practices aren't torture. His argument is that they stop short of inflicting serious physical harm. And the other bone of contention he has is the media in the US have been reporting that there was no gain from waterboarding. They didn't get any sort of valuable information or any significant information as a result of waterboarding. And the fact that it was used so often sort of indicates that it wasn't effective. Now, Hayden disputes this. He says that there was significant material gained as a result of what he refers to as enhanced interrogation techniques. And the CIA themselves separately said that claim that as a result of these, they managed to stop sort of second wave of 9/11 style attacks in Los Angeles.
And meanwhile, there's been a report in the New York Times that says that the CIA used the technique of waterboarding much more extensively than had previously been thought.
Yeah, the New York Times got this information from a blogger. When the memos were released, a lot of that information was redacted, it was blacked out. But for some reason, some of the people who received the memos, it wasn't as blacked out as certainly the memos that I've seen. But this blogger, Empty Wheels, managed to find memos in which that crucial information was revealed. And that revealed that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was subjected to waterboarding an extraordinary 183 times. And I think that was just in 1 month alone, August 2003. And that another detainee, Abu Zubaydah, who was arrested the previous year, I think in 2002, in Pakistan, he was subjected to 83 times.
How much support or not does this give to Mr. Hayden's view that waterboarding was a useful interrogation technique?
The fact that they had to do it so often seems to undermine his argument. If you have to waterboard somebody 183 times, then that suggests that 182 times he didn't tell you much anyway. In the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he apparently confessed to lots of things, and he seems to have accepted responsibility for every terrorist act that took place between 1993 and when he was arrested in 2003. He admitted to Al Jazeera before the Americans took him into custody that he had responsibility for some things, but the way he seemed to have been confessing to everything seemed odd to me at the time. Hayden and the CIA might not think waterboarding constitutes torture, but for much of the rest of the world, it is regarded as torture. And that throws into doubt the credibility of the information that's been extracted in this way.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come, food critic Jay Rayner on how the world's best restaurants are coping with the credit crunch.
Although there will be people who go to the wall, it's not going to be the end of high-concept dining by any means.
But first, with the world gripped by recession, many governments have attempted to stave off the downturn and revive their economies by means of a fiscal stimulus. That's a huge injection of cash by the state. Well, a further benefit of fiscal stimulus is the opportunity to make an economy more environmentally friendly. But despite rhetoric from Gordon Brown about a Green New Deal, research by HSBC found that the share of Britain's fiscal stimulus considered to be green was just 7%. That's about half the international average of 15%. As Alistair Darling puts the finishing touches to tomorrow's budget speech, he might like to consider the case of South Korea. 80% of its fiscal stimulus was environmental. Jonathan Watts is our Asia environment correspondent. So, how are South Korea's green billions being spent?
Actually, that is the key question, and nobody is quite sure yet, including the government, which is still drawing up the details of how exactly the money is going to be spent. As you've said, it has promised that the vast proportion of the money will go on creating what it calls green jobs. HSBC Bank, the British bank, has in an international ranking said that South Korea has invested more in green projects in its stimulus plan than any other country. So they're saying this is the greenest New Deal on the planet at the moment. However, environmental groups are extremely skeptical that it really will be green. They believe that the president of South Korea, Lee Myung-bak, has a long track record in the construction industry. He's the former head of Hyundai Construction, and they fear that actually this is just going to be a bit of greenwashing for an old-style fiscal stimulus package that basically pours a lot of concrete.
So are there any lessons for Alistair Darling, the British Chancellor, as he considers his budget tomorrow?
I think there are. Despite the suspicions of environmental groups, there are some fairly ambitious goals in South Korea's green package. For example, perhaps the most impressive of them is that the government said it will build 1 million new green homes that will be energy efficient. 1 million more old homes will be retrofitted to make them more energy efficient. There will be a huge investment, $1.8 billion in renewable energy, and another $7 billion, and this is US money, on high-speed railways and other forms of clean transport. So it's serious money being put into these kinds of projects. We have to see if it really goes on where the government says it's going to go. But this is no half-hearted measure, and that is something that perhaps any country can take as an example.
John, are there any surprises in this stimulus package?
There are some unusual elements. The government has promised to construct 4,000 kilometres of bicycle expressways across the nation, including a 200-kilometre stretch alongside the demilitarised zone with North Korea. And there are real questions about exactly who would want to go cycling on these routes. Perhaps more impressive is the fact that every single public building in the country is going to have a light bulb change. They're all going to be fitted with light-emitting diodes, which are much more efficient. So there's going to be a lot of electricians and public workers changing bulbs over the next few months.
Jonathan Watts. Now, a quick mention that you can follow Guardian Daily on Twitter. That's at twitter.com/Guardian Daily. Ferron Adria's legendary El Bulli has again topped a list of the world's greatest restaurants. Spain has more entries towards the top of the list than any other country. Once again, Heston Blumenthal's Fat Duck held the number two spot in the San Pellegrino list, which was compiled by hundreds of chefs, restaurateurs, food writers and restaurant critics, including The Observer's Jay Rayner.
I chose the 30 or so people who covered the UK, and each of us had to vote for five restaurants, three of which had to be outside our own region and two in our own region. There are 26 such panels, so 800 or so judges around the world. We each vote for five restaurants, and then the scores are tallied together.
So, I mean, looking at the international picture, how have British restaurants fared?
I think it's fair to say that we're not massively represented this year, which is probably as it should be. I think we've got four in the top 50, and two of those, weirdly, are a Japanese restaurant, Nobu, and a Chinese restaurant, Hakkasan. And then we have St. John, Fergus Henderson's same place, and of course we have the number two restaurant in the world, the Fat Duck. So not massively overrepresented, but I have to say, looking at the world taken as a whole, I think that's probably about right.
One of the casualties in this year's list was Gordon Ramsay's restaurant. What happened to him?
I think the way you have to look at this list is by no means comprehensive. If we ever claimed that it was the final word on the best restaurants in the world, we'd deserve a complete slapping. But what it is, you know, a general court of opinion involving 800 very knowledgeable chefs, restaurateurs and critics. And when they were asked to name the five best restaurants they'd eaten at in the last 18 months, clearly very few of them named Gordon Ramsay's restaurant on Royal Hospital Road in Chelsea. Interestingly, what they did name was that of his estranged protege, Marcus Waring, at the Barclay. So, you know, if you're looking for controversy and shouty headlines, that's probably it. There's a sense from this, I suppose, that what's going on at the Michelin three-star Gordon Ramsay at Royal Hospital Road is less exciting, thrilling than once it was, and all the excitement and big news is elsewhere.
Will high-concept dining survive the global economic recession?
I think the answer is yes, there will be casualties. There's no doubt about that. It's expensive and it's difficult to run and the economics are very, very tough. But, you know, high concept restaurants are nothing new and neither are recessions. And they've always survived. And they've always survived because it's possible to trim your business model to fit the circumstances. And it's also one of those realities. There are always people out there willing to spend a bit of money on dinner as a way of, you know, making life feel a bit better. So although there will be people who go to the wall, it's not going to be the end of high concept dining by any means.
Jay Rayner, Ian Chambers and Roxanne Escobales produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.